Hello, and welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors, recorded live in the U.S. and the U.K., usually with the writer in the room. My name is Cedaring Fox. I am Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
My name is Kirsty Pitt, Word Theater's U.K. founder and creative partner.
I was in England with Kirsty last month, October 2021. We had two live shows in London. Plus, Kirsty hosted our 10th annual Writers' Workshop in her gorgeous town up in the Peak District.
We were delighted to be joined by the fabulous writer, Nicholas Royal, who did happen to comment that Word Theatre is a movement. Well, on that note, we just have to invite you all to join us.
Yes, we want all of you to become Word Theatre members, but more on that later. Now, we have an anniversary to celebrate. Jane Smiley joined us at Word Theatre in Los Angeles a few years ago to experience Amy Brenneman give an unforgettable reading of Jane's searing, powerful short story, The Life of the Body. In honor of the 30-year anniversary of the publication of Jane's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, A Thousand Acres, which my book club has been reading this month, we are releasing this recording of Amy's remarkable reading. Jane Smiley has so far written two short story collections, five nonfiction books, and more than 20 novels, for which she has won countless awards. Many of these novels center around horses, perhaps her greatest passion. To introduce her story, please welcome the author, Jane Smiley.
This is Jane Smiley. This is my story, The Life of the Body. When I was in my 30s, I wrote short stories and novellas that expressed a lot of the fears that I had when my world expanded to include having small children. I was always fearful that something might happen. My imagination was alive to fear, danger, impulsive behavior, chaos, and I used writing to explore some of those issues. When my children got older, I became less fearful, and my imagination got more free, more political, and more comical. I have to say that that was relief. But when I go back to these stories, I am struck by their intensity, and they do still affect me.
I had been going to call my sister Rhonda when the phone rang, and even then, when I heard her voice, I thought that I could just open my mouth and tell her. But when she heaved a blue premenstrual sigh and said, "So what are you going to do today?" I just said what I always say, "Oh, nothing." I thought, another day, just another day. Then the time will be more right somehow. The fact is that I am in about the worst trouble that I have ever heard of anyone being in. After Rhonda hung up, the phone rang four separate times. There is no one I dare to hear from, and so I let it ring. If I had picked up, I would have said to anyone on the other end that I am pregnant, that Jonathan Rickliffs is the father, not Jake, my husband, and that everything inside me is about to be revealed. Layer by layer, to Jake, to Jonathan, to Rhonda and our parents, to my son Ezra and my daughter Nancy, to people who care about me and to people who barely know me. What is it that will shame me most when it is revealed? Maybe it is the crazy force of my desire for Jonathan, the full extent of which I have kept from him and which makes me squirm with discomfort even as a secret. But maybe it is something else, something that has not even been revealed to me yet. I used to have three children. The third was Dory. 5 months ago, when she was almost three, she fell head over heels down the stairs. She went over three times, we think. She broke her neck at the bottom and died that afternoon. Various children around the country have her liver, her kidneys, her corneas. There was no one to receive her heart at that moment. A heart is something that can't be saved for very long. She had a little book in her hand when Jake found her at the bottom. It was a habit we couldn't break her of, reading on the stairs. Really, she didn't know how to read yet, but she loved to look at the pictures. I was getting dressed in our bedroom. Jake was ironing his shirt, and Nancy and Ezra were eating breakfast. We all heard the long cry of surprise and fear, the thump of limbs toppling and hitting, the utter silence of the house around those noises. All struck dumb, all thinking, what's that? All listening. The rustle of buttonholes stopped. The swish of the iron stopped. The interior crunch of cereal and toast stopped. I can't say what I would have given to have been standing at the bottom of the stairs, holding out my arms to catch Dory. My inner life isn't very mysterious or symbolic. I often dream that I am there, that she is saved, and some part of me in the dream always asserts that even if the last time was a dream, this time it is true. It isn't. Jake wouldn't let me speak at the funeral. He was afraid I would say something outrageous. I might have said, what right do I have to grieve, having lost only one? Isn't the society of mothers who have lost some many times bigger than the society of mothers who have kept all theirs? I would have said a lot of contradictory things since I was very confused. Instead, we thanked God who took her away for giving us to her in the first place. That was Jake's idea. He is a religious person, more so now. Jonathan is a fatalist rather than a providentialist. Things come and go. Forces arrange themselves so that he will, for example, eat granola instead of a peach. When I think of the way he sees himself, I imagine a kind of pinpoint at the vortex of a whirlpool, Blakean swirls above his head, streaks of light moving through darkness. He is not a very hopeful person. I used to tease him about it. When I tell him I am pregnant, he will nod slowly, his expectations of the worst confirmed. Maybe that is what I hate most about this, all the suspicions confirmed, especially the suspicions about me that everyone seems to harbor, that Dory's death has made me crazy, that Jake and I have never gotten along, that I would do anything to tie Jonathan to me, that I want to replace Dory at any cost, that women are by nature evil, irresponsible, and deceptive. Yeah, what does it say in the Bible? And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. All that stuff. Once on the Today Show, I saw a man who had written a book about the Dion quintuplets. When they were born, the mother was ashamed. She said, people will think that we are pigs. So much intercourse revealed to the world. Well, I was never proud of my pregnancies. Just by looking at you, people know what you were thinking about. I could have told Jake last night. I could have told Jonathan last night, too, when he brought over some lettuce from the garden. It doesn't make it any easier that this will be the first news Jake has had of my affair with Jonathan. Jonathan talks well to Jake. Not many people do. Jake is antisocial and impatient, and his idea of a serviceable conversational gambit is, what do you want? Someone else who talks well to Jake is Rhonda. I'm tempted to tell her and then let her tell them all. She is a great moaner. Oh, Sarah. That's how she listens to confidences, moaning those wordless cries that you would like to be moaning yourself. Oh, Sarah. I try it out loud, but it isn't the same. I know I should be finishing the sentence, ooh, Sarah, you shithead, which is something Rhonda would never think of doing. There is the crunch of wheels in the driveway. Jake returning from work, as he often does. He will find me standing over the sink, as he often does. I get up and position myself there. He comes in and runs up the stairs. There is the slamming of closet doors upstairs, the thump of heavy feet. He really has forgotten something. He always really has, but he never did before Dory died. The manifestation of his grief is more than forgetfulness. It is a perennial searching. Though he gave up smoking years ago, his hands wander his pockets in search of cigarettes. He's always making sure he has his keys, his wallet, his checkbook. I find him in closets looking for sweaters and pairs of slippers and magazine articles we threw out years ago. He turns over the cushions, puts his hands in the cracks, comes up with pennies that he gives to Nancy. He calls his mother and asks if his old yearbooks are at her house, his swimming trunks from high school, his old Bo Diddley records. We are patient with this searching, his mother and I. Even Jake knows what he is searching for, but he can't stop just because he won't find her. He appears in the kitchen doorway. I have my hands in the water as if I were doing something. And it might be that, not looking at him, looking out the back window at the peonies blooming in the yard, I will say, I'm pregnant. I know the words. I've said it before. But of everyone in the whole world, Jake is the only other person who knows that we haven't slept together since the week before Dory died. It is also possible that I will tell no one. Just wait for them to notice and ask. It may be that social nicety will prevent most people from asking. It may be that fear will prevent Jake from asking, and even greater fear will prevent Jonathan from asking. And a year from now, I will say in a cocky voice, "Ever wonder where I got this baby?" Jake says, "I forgot the reports. I can't believe I actually forgot the reports." "It's okay." "Well, of course it's okay. That isn't what I'm talking about. I just can't believe it. I'm just remarking on it, is all." "I know. What are you going to do today?" he asks suspiciously, because he thinks that my grief is to loiter around the house for hours and then hurry and clean up just before Ezra and Nancy get home. It was. Lately, my grief has been to go to bed with Jonathan Rickliffe as much as possible on every flat surface in his apartment. But I say, "I'm going to Rhonda's dance class with her again, and then I'm going to order meat at the locker, then bake cookies with Nancy for the day camp birthday party. How about cooking out for dinner? It's already getting hot enough. Will you make potato salad?" He glides up next to me, kisses me on the neck as if bribing me. I turn and put my hands on his shoulders. I smile as if being bribed. "I'll boil the potatoes as soon as you leave." The day camp counselor thinks Nancy seems fine. She's playing with everyone and the shyness has worn off completely. She's making a belt in the crafts class. Good. Ezra is being more reserved. Well, Ezra is more reserved. How much more? Well, sweetie, I wish I knew. He likes the horses. Yesterday, he told me about the horses for about 25 minutes. His favorite is named Herb. He got to go to the stable and give Herb his oats. We smile at Herb. Jake smiles at me. He thinks we are coming out of things when, in fact, we are just getting started. Another day. I'll let him go another day. He pecks me on the cheek and leaves with a number of slams. The kitchen door, the garage door, the car door. He is a noisy man. Rhonda dances every day. Lately, I've been going with her. But this is not aerobics. It is serious modern dance. The other students are mostly in their teens and early 20s. The teacher is a black man who dances in a local company. I don't know why he lets me come, except that he is a friend of Rhonda's and she is my sister. Rhonda, although she is 32 and has two children, turns out to have considerable talent for the dance. The first day I came, she warmed up, without shame, by stretching and then doing three slow cartwheels and a couple of handstands. I was amazed. I keep up well with the slower third of the 20-year-olds, and mostly Henry doesn't pay any attention to us. We pay attention to him, though. Pas de cheval. Henry says, "You know how a puppy licks your arm? So that every pore and hair gets wet, we'll make that sole of your foot lick the floor." Deep second position. "You are in water. Your head is floating upward. Your knees are floating outward. Lift, lift!" He tells us not to mimic him, but to feel ourselves, our muscles and tendons sliding and rolling, our balls and sockets rotating. Today we have hamstrings and adductors for half an hour, then chaîne turns for half an hour. My days here, as everywhere, are numbered. And so when we lie on our backs and rotate our hips outward and find the place on each side where the tendons split, I am careful to note what it feels like. When we then curl up to standing, I think only of my spine, cat-like, and my long, furry tail anchoring me to the floor. When we step and pivot across the floor, I push my toes through the wet mud Henry evokes and leave long swaths filling the water behind me. After four times across the floor, we lie down and slither through that same mud, chests first, trying not to get our chins wet. The first to go are Nancy and Ezra, who are active and well taken care of. Then I stop thinking about Rhonda, even though she's just ahead of me in line. Jake vanishes next, with his expectations that are soon to be betrayed. Now Dory, who never knew me as a dancer, who has no associations with this room or these people. They know my first name only, if that. After that, I forget I am pregnant. And at last, sometime in the triple prances, "Slide, snap, snap," says Henry. Even Jonathan. "Let's go." Henry becomes Henry the dancer rather than Henry the man. We are panting. Henry tells the accompanist to speed up the tempo, and we are running. Henry goes first, down, up, up, arms and chin swooping, then lifting. Someone in red and black does it after him, a flute passage on the heels of a bassoon passage, and then it is me. And the only thing I feel is the slick floor under my feet and the rush of my fingers through the air. Up, up. The one in red and black, of course, is Rhonda, who is damp with sweat from ponytail to heel. And when class is over, she says, "God, let's shower and eat at my place. I've got some spaghetti left over from last night." It is the words that bring them all back with a suffocating rush. God, my place, last night. We are fixed in time and place, after all. Henry passes us on the way out. "Lovely," he says. "He's a big man, happy," Rhonda says, "because he gets a lot of oxygen to the brain." I should tell her in the locker room, naked in the shower, but I make excuses. Now that she is right here, it seems like Jonathan should be the first to know. Then Jake, then her, then our parents, then the children. That's the obvious order, just as Rhonda, Jake, Jonathan was last night. When Jake and Jonathan were standing with their hands in their pockets under the hackberry tree, considering ways to save it from whatever is infesting it. There is this space, of course, this carefully made space in the day when I will see Jonathan. After the meat locker, after lunch, before Nancy and Ezra get home from day camp, I enter the downstairs door quickly and run up. The door opens at the first brush of my first knock. Jonathan is grinning. "Hi," he says. "Hi, hi, hi." He locks the door behind me. He looks me up and down. I catch sight of a pot of tea steaming behind him on the coffee table, and I burst into tears. It isn't the first time. Nor does it come from the press of present circumstances. All of this sadness has been there from the beginning. I think, in fact, that this affair was begun as a tribute to sadness, gathered force through sadness, and will result in more sadness for everyone than we can possibly stand. I feel utterly comfortable weeping here. Perhaps more importantly, Jonathan feels utterly comfortable with my weeping. I sit on the couch and he pours the tea, and then he sits beside me and folds me into his chest, and soon I am weeping and kissing him. And he is wiping my face with a paper napkin and kissing me, and that is how it has gone for months. Salty kisses, passion, and grief. I am, as they say, shameless. Often we don't make love, but today we do. Today, when he kisses me with his lips, I give him my tongue, only my tongue. And then I feel his meeting mine, and instantly my nipples, tender with pregnancy, stand up. Burning. As much as they hurt, I long to have him lick and suck them, and when I think of that, they tingle suddenly, as if milk were about to come down. They haven't done that since Dory was nursing, and it is the most intense feeling of physical longing, the longing to give suck. I almost tell the news, but I don't. Jonathan kisses my neck and shoulders, and his erection presses against my leg, presses into my imagination. The thick, smooth shape, the reddish color. I am as familiar with it as I am with my own hand. More familiar, since I have looked at it, tasted it, touched and held it, smelled it. A weighty, living object. Sometimes at night after Jake goes to sleep and I am lying awake in fear and guilt, I just open my mouth and put my tongue out, wishing, thinking how I would lick the little crease and then wrung my tongue under the cap, marveling always at the warm shape of it. He sucks my breasts and I put my hands into his pants, unsnapping them, forcing the zipper down. He hops a little on the couch, then pulls my t-shirt up. It tangles in my arms and hair, and I'm still weeping. I am happy to be trapped inside this shirt with my nipples burning, my cunt throbbing. I open my mouth and put my tongue out. Sarah, he moans. Oh, Sarah. Oh, oh. And then he strips off my shorts and shoes and sucks my toes. And after that, he licks my cunt and licks, parting the lips and putting his fingers in, licking, finding at last the spot that burns so that I push him away, his head, his shoulders. He pushes back, licking, his tongue fastened to that spot. My legs turn to water and my back arches. And for a moment, he's gone. And then he eases into me, slow and slick, and his tongue is in my open mouth, and his fingers are in my ears, and his chest, smooth and firm in its way as a penis, is sliding along my chest. And then he does something I always like, which is to lift my legs to my shoulder so that he can get in, and he gets in so far that he relaxes a little and closes his eyes. I push him off, out. He is shocked. His flesh is shocked at the suddenness of it, but before he realizes, I have it, his penis, in my mouth as I have wanted, and I am licking and stroking. I like to feel this, that he cannot stop himself. He does not. I swallow. He falls back on the couch, pulling me with him, holding me tight, panting. This is the way it has gone for months. I cling to him in desperate fear. But I am no longer weeping. Sometimes I dream that I am just a torso and blind, born that way. Skin, a mouth, breasts, a cunt more open than any cunt ever. And Jonathan is engulfing me as well as penetrating every orifice. I dream that all I can do in life is fuck and suck and kiss and be embraced, and that I orgasm over and over and never get enough. Sometimes I daydream it. The tension flows back into his chest. I feel it along my chest and his shoulder, where my ear and cheek rest. His arm tightens over my back and his other arm moves. When I lift my head to look at him, I see that he has covered his eyes with his elbow. I lower my head gently and wait, as still as possible. His heart has not relaxed and is pounding steadily faster. As I open my mouth to speak, he says, Sarah, talk to me. I lift my head. You want me to open the conversation? It's hopeless. What is hopeless? I can't make it a question, must make it a denial. Sarah, don't say anything. Just don't say anything. Do you love me? He answers without hesitation, but not without pain. I tell you, I do, over and over, I do. Then don't say anything. Do you love me? I think of you without ceasing day and night. Do you love me? You possess me. Sarah, do you love me? After minutes go by and I don't answer, he sits up and puts me away from him and pours the tea. I reach for my t-shirt and pull it on, but I don't stop shivering. I watch him drink his tea, catching tea leaves on the tip of his tongue and picking them off with his finger. He knows I am looking at him, and from time to time turns his gaze to mine. This is another thing that we feel comfortable with, staring and being stared at. He is a big man, broad and muscular, utterly defeated, as an ox goeth to the slaughter. When we met, I was attracted to his self-reliance, his detached outlook. Yeah, both of those are gone now. I wonder how much he wants them back. He says, I am terrified. Are you terrified that it will go on, or are you terrified that it will stop? Both. Are you frightened of me or for me? Both. Will love find a way? If we stick together, can we make it? Sometimes I think so. Weaker moments. Oh, Sarah. He covers his eyes again. A moment later, I see tears on his cheeks. I look away. He goes on, It's too painful. Sometimes I feel like our clothes are lined with nails, and the tighter we embrace, the more blood we draw from each other. I say, it was fun at the beginning. That's important. A book I read says that you draw on the strengths of the relationship when you remember the beginning. I used to be known for my sense of humor, actually. Jonathan, suspend choice, all right? No action, no decision, just endurance. But he is slippery. As soon as he admitted fear, I felt it myself telegraphed from him to me. I felt the size of the betrayal that would be possible just to escape that fear. Which arm, which leg, which sense would I have given just to escape that fear the moment I saw my daughter at the bottom of the stairs? A day, I say. Only another day. Don't make up your mind or think anything for another day. Go canoeing. Go to the movies. Eat something soothing with lots of B vitamins. If I leave now, I might beat Nancy home by a minute. I run out the door, down the steps, out the lower door. I know he is watching me from the window. He fell in love with me when Dory died. That is why my chest closes up when I try to say that I love him. I don't want to be loved for my belongings, even if that belonging is only an enlargement that springs from tragedy. I make a lot of mistakes. This time it is the potato salad, which I forgot, though Jake asked it for it specifically. I forgot about it all the way until he looked in the refrigerator and said, "Didn't you make the potato salad?" And so there was no evasion action possible. I say, "I'll do that thing." "What thing?" "That thing where I go to the deli and get some of theirs, then redress it. You like that. You were going to put the potatoes on as soon as I left." "I forgot." "How could you forget? You were standing right here in the kitchen. All you had to do was turn around and take the potatoes out of the cupboard." "I forgot. I'm not mad. I don't understand you. You forgot your reports? I was working on them last night. I put them aside. I don't want to argue about fine points." "It means something," he says. "The way people act means something. You know that." "I forgot." He shakes his head and goes outside to start the fire. Before he addressed me on the topic of potato salad, I was standing over the dishwater, as always, washing up the cookie things and pondering the recollection of Jonathan sucking my breasts, thinking that I would like him to kiss all of my skin at the same time. Jonathan knows in his heart that what I crave from him are impossibilities. That is why he is afraid of me. At the kitchen window, Jake comes into view, carrying the charcoal and the lighter fluid. Most people, including Jonathan, feel lots of sympathy for him. Soon they'll feel more. They think he must grieve a great deal for Dory. I don't know. I wish I had seen the first look on his face when he got to her, but I started from back in the closet in our bedroom upstairs, and by the time I reached them at the bottom of the stairs, he was already practical, had already covered her with the Afghan and was calling the ambulance, wouldn't let her be moved. He has never cried in my presence. Nor have I cried in his presence. But we do not pretend that everything is normal. We strive with all our might to make a routine, a little thread that will guide Ezra and Nancy, and maybe ourselves, out of the labyrinth. That our sex life ended did not surprise me. Jake does not seek comfort in the flesh of others. He has to feel good to reach out. When he does not feel good, he avoids people. All of his brothers are the same way. When their father died 3 years ago, they gathered in Tallahassee for 4 days, 5 men. They built a bathroom out of the downstairs porch of their mother's house, taking maybe 4 hours out for the funeral and the burial. I asked Jake if they talked about their father in there while they were grouting and caulking. He said, "Ralph did, a little." He didn't touch me for 4 months. I didn't mind. I think about Jonathan putting his face between my thighs and licking, sticking his tongue in. Jake comes up behind me and says, "Are you going to get the potato salad now or not?" And I start violently. He turns me around, his hands on my shoulders, and looks into my eyes. His face is very close to mine, and he is serious. He says, "Sarah, can't you pay attention? That's not an accusation. I want to know. Is that the problem, that you can't pay attention?" "I'm trying. Don't watch me." I wish I could help myself. I pull away. I'll get the potato salad now, okay? Nancy is over at Allison's house and Ezra is watching television. Don't get distracted. Half an hour, okay? Be back in half an hour. I will. I mean it. I will. It is for my own good, so I won't wander. So I will keep my mind on the business at hand. That is the beginning. The second incident takes place when I'm coming out of Nancy's room after putting her to bed. Jake is in the hallway looking at the bookshelves. I turn to say one last thing to Nancy, and Jake's arm goes around my waist. Distracted, I stiffen. Then I relax, but the stiffening doesn't go unnoticed. His arm drops. We stand there for an awkward second. Then he chooses a book, and I turn and go down the stairs. In the end, we argue about religion rather than sex. It is dark when I come into our bedroom, and I think Jake is asleep, but he speaks in a firm, clear voice, surprising in the dark. Can I tell you something? I push the top drawer of the dresser in, and he takes this for assent. I stand quietly, looking at the parallelogram of moonlight on the top of the dresser. There was this time, after my mother's younger sister died of complications of childbirth, I guess I was about 14. Anyway, we had just moved to that house in Tallahassee, and I came in from doing something outside. Maybe we were helping Dad move that shed. That was one of the first things we had to do. It was almost dark, and Mom was sitting in the dark, snapping beans for dinner, and everyone else was outside. And when I went to turn on the light, she said, "Jake, leave it dark." So I left it dark, and she said, "The Lord helps a man be good, Jake. If you let him come inside you, he is a tide that carries you to goodness. But you've got to open that door yourself." That was all she said. And then Richie came in and turned on the light, and pretty soon we had dinner. "Sarah, I know it's hard to find that door. It took me 10 years to find the door, but I found it. It's not a door I want to find, Jake. Your mother was a religious woman, and she raised you, and so she was preaching to the converted. Before we got married, she said you'd come back to it, and you did. Big surprise. I tried the other way. You always thought of it as the other way. I don't believe, Jake. It's not in me. My brain doesn't have that bump. It's not in my horoscope. I went to Sunday school and read the Bible, and it didn't take. If you didn't bring it up, I wouldn't think about it. But maybe me bringing it up is the Lord's way of trying to get your attention. I can't stop doing it. I am moved to do it. Don't you understand what that means? By now, I have gotten, without realizing it, into the dark corner between the dresser and the wall. I open my mouth, but I know perfectly well how Jake's life looked to him. In retrospect, a series of perfectly timed nudges toward the right path that his mother would have, and often had, called miracles. A moment of despair, and then she looks up to see the minister on the porch about to ring the bell. That happened more than once. I didn't necessarily discount her interpretation. It does seem to me that the world and the inner life mesh in mysterious ways more often than not. I run my finger around the edge of the moonlight. More than anything, I want him to stop badgering me. I say, "I understand that you are driving me nuts with this God shit. I got some tracts in the mail yesterday again. Did you send them?" He is out of bed in an instant, moved to rage by everything unbearable that we have to bear. I find that I am in a tight spot between the wall and the dresser, and as I am trying to get out, he takes me by the shoulders and bumps my head on the wall. I press into him, his grip tightens, and I can feel the panic roll up from my toes all at once. I know he won't hurt me, but I feel that he will kill me. The walls behind me and to my left are unyielding, cold, terrifying. I bend down. His hands press harder on my shoulders, weights that I cannot evade. I do the only thing that I can possibly do, which is to push hard against the wall with my hip and hard against the dresser with my hands. It falls over with a crash, and the stained glass box Jake keeps pennies in flies toward the window. I see this out of the corner of my eye. Jake does it again, bumps my head against the wall, this time hard and simultaneously with the sound of breaking glass. Then I get out from under him, clamber over the dresser, and flee the room. For the rest of the night, which I spend on the sofa, every time I fall into a doze, I seem to feel my head being slammed into glass, and when I wake up, expecting to reach up and find blood pouring down my face. When I loved Jake, when our relationship wasn't too complicated to have a label like that, it was this absolute quality that I loved. this straightness, this desire for goodness, and mostly the struggle he put up with himself, the manly difficulty of that. I didn't know anyone like him. I don't know that this appreciation is reciprocated. When he talks about me to his pastor and other men he likes who are religious, they will have a long tradition of misogyny to consult. He will not be guided to see things from my point of view. Well, deep in the night, curled up on the couch with the pillow over my head, somewhere in the realm of sleep, I do feel what he felt and see what he saw and hear and what he heard. The flippant and dismissive tone of my voice, the indifference of my face in the half light, the inviting and unusual way I was wedged into that space, easy prey and deserving of punishment too. Feel again the corner enclosing my flesh, the panic surging out of me in a flood, and I wake up with a start. Containing both points of view at once makes me short of breath. I sit up and gaze around the living room. For the first time in weeks, I don't want Jonathan. I try to make myself think of him, and my mind won't fix. Jonathan used to run a millworks, producing hardwood moldings for lumber yards. He made some money and sold the business, and now he goes to school in horticulture and landscape architecture. He taught an extension course in tree fruits, which is where I met him, and which is why he has his days free and why he can talk to Jake, whose only ambition in life is to run a market garden with his brother, Richie. Richie would grow only corn. Jake would do the other vegetables and press cider in the fall. I would do fresh-cut flowers in season and apples in the fall. Well, right now, Jake and Richie have other jobs. Richie manages a big A&P in the next town, and Jake works for the county government as an accountant. Jake and Richie and I own 57 acres, free and clear. Next summer, the five brothers are going to begin building a house on the land. Every weekend, all spring, Jake and Richie have gone out to the property and walked its every inch, looking for the best site for the house and the garden buildings. That gave Jonathan and me 4 or 5 extra hours every week that we wouldn't have had. And it was on one of those weekends, when I forgot my diaphragm, that I got pregnant. In the 10 years of marriage, I have forgotten it off and on without consequences, and each of the other pregnancies took a number of months, so I was careless. Careless and lazy. I realized I had forgotten it before I was to the end of our street, but I couldn't bear to turn back and thought I would trust to luck as I had in the past. Careless and lazy and possessed. There have been times in the last 7 months when putting off seeing Jonathan for even 10 minutes was the cruelest torture. We bought the property 2 years ago with savings and with Jake's and Richie's portions of their father's estate. I like Richie. All that summer, he would come over about dinner time and sit on the porch swing, talking to Jake about what sort of house they would build and watching Dory. Dory was 16 months when we bought the land. When Richie was here, we would prop open all the doors and she would charge through all the rooms and in and out of the house. He would help her down the front steps and she would tear around the yard, which was fenced. She was utterly safe and utterly free. And maybe for that reason, much happier than Nancy and Ezra were at that age. Rhonda and Walker came over a lot, too. We've all known each other for a long time. Lots of times, Rhonda would go into the kitchen and open the cabinets and start making dinner. And though I had disagreements with Jake that everyone knew about, there was a largeness and comfort to family life that soothed me. It spread in every direction, over the landscape, from the past into the future. It was enough to buy land and plan, to care for the children, to dig and plant. Richie and Walker distracted Jake, engaging him in conversation, made him feel at ease. Whatever was missing between us got to seem like just a certain coloring, a certain way the landscape might be lit, but wasn't nothing particular, considering everything else that was there. Richie, after all, wasn't even married, had never, as far as we know, had a steady girlfriend. Usually, these days, it seems like nothing, what we had at all those dinner times. But just now, when I'm cold and tired and frightened of sleep, it seems like a thing of substance and weight, safe as a vault, with the child rolling through it like a golden ball. I don't know anyone who's had an abortion, but it can be done. Rhonda would know all about it. And if this were the moment when it was to be done, I would do it, because no one else is here. Not Jonathan or Nancy or Ezra or Jake or Richie or Rhonda or my mother. Only I am here. And for the moment, Jake has pounded sentiment out of me. Nothing in this room, which we bought and filled with our purchases, means a thing to me, not even the pictures. Nothing I have ever felt or thought or given voice to remotely interests me just now. No principle or affection or intention. I sit against the arm of the couch, waiting to make up my mind to have an abortion. Instead, it must be that I fall asleep, because Ezra wakes me, and it is daylight, though just barely. Ezra always comes down early and expects to have the house to himself for an hour. He says, "Mommy, can I turn on the TV?" And the day has begun. I look at him for a long moment until he smiles in self-defense, and then I say, "Do you have writing again today?" And he grins. He says, "Alan, you know, the head of writing, he said I could write Herbie every day if I asked." He goes and turns on the TV, then glances back at me. "He's a real good horse, Mom. And he's a horse, not a pony." Do you know the difference? I do, actually. Well, he's a horse. That's good, sweetie. I pull myself up the stairs and into the bathroom. At breakfast, I act as if nothing has happened, and Jake can think of getting away with something if he wants. I put his eggs in front of him and meet his gaze, and I am nearly as tender with him as I am with children, brushing their shoulders or hair with my hand. And then they are gone, and I pick up the phone and I call Jonathan and make a date with him for lunch. His voice is distant, distracted. After that, I make sure that Rhonda is going to her dance class and that I can come along. Then I do the dishes and sweep the kitchen. In fact, I get down on my hands and knees with the butler's brush and sweep like I've never swept before, getting the dust and sand of 7 years out of the corners, off the top edge of the moldings, out from under the stove and refrigerator. When I am finished, I am dusty and sweaty. I go around and open the windows, catching what breeze there is. After that, I take another shower. The fact is that this is the last hour of the old life. Things that are soft are about to harden and take the simple shapes that may last them the rest of my life. For example, I don't hate Jake, and I don't love Jonathan. Whatever I feel for each of them is like one of those dye baths that dip the end papers of books in, a riot of colors swirl together, compounded of everything each has confided in me and everything I have confided in each of them. At this moment, I have the feeling that each time I have looked at each of them is distinct and significant, that I know some discrete grain of truth about each of them as a result of every glance. The large thing that I know about them is that they are not each other. But that large thing is compounded of the numberless small ways in which they are not each other. I don't blame them for not being each other. But as soon as I speak, they will move into position. Jake, betrayed, will become my enemy. Jonathan, responsible, will become my partner. I will be deluding myself if I don't know that he will consider my pregnancy a moral outrage, in addition to an injury to himself, if he doesn't tell his brothers and probably my children that I am a whore. And then he wouldn't be the Jake that I have known for 10 years. And so the children will move into position too, confused at first, judgmental later, damaged forever. And Jonathan, well, Jonathan, just because I know that he will do the right thing, does that mean I plan for him too? At lunch, I tell him I'm pregnant before he tells me we have to end our affair, and for a lot of reasons, he will swallow his doubts and I will swallow mine. And sometime soon, I will tell him that I love him, because I will love him. I will move into position too. Maybe. A week after the funeral, when the children were back in school, I walked to the library and then to Jonathan's house. It was the day before Valentine's Day, warm and sunny, with snowmelt trickling down every gutter. I had thrown away the Valentine I intended to give him. It was one of those cynical and sexy ones, and when I found it in my purse the day after the funeral, it seemed to be cursed, so I tore it up. Tore it up again, took it down the street and threw it into some dry cleaner's dumpster. I was chastened. Everything having to do with Jonathan Rickliffe's frightened me. We hadn't slept together very often. Our friendship was more teasing and drinking tea than anything else. He seemed invulnerable, possibly dating someone else, though I wasn't sure. Jake was at work, my mother had left, the children were back in school, and I was walking down the street, glad to be put back together a little bit, glad that the previous night was over and the night to come wasn't yet upon me. I climbed the step and rang the bell, and I remember turning and looking down the street, idly, thinking of nothing for a moment. And then the door opened, and Jonathan was there. And his hand closed around my elbow, and he pulled me into the hallway, where he hugged me and looked at me and put his hand on my face and then hugged me again. And just at that moment, when he looked at me, I knew two things at once. That Dory was dead, and that Jonathan loved me, as he had not loved me 10 days before. I don't know that any relationship can survive that sort of birth for long. Or maybe the root is this, that when I was standing in the closet that morning, buttoning my shirt, it was Jonathan I was thinking of. Jonathan, who had delayed me in the closet, taking off one shirt and putting on another. I was thinking about him sucking my breasts. I could feel my nipples rise against the cotton of the shirt as I thought, what's that noise? In the first hour of the new life, I will speak and act and justify and choose. I will summarize and simplify in order to make the new life. I will start forgetting what I know in the last hour of the old life. I don't think this is the least of the things that will be destroyed. I'm pulling on my tights in the locker room when Rhonda comes in. She is lovely, my sister. She has two dimples, still. One just under her left eye, the other just to the right of her smile. In the humidity, her hair springs out of her bun with curly abandon. Sari, she roars. Her voice is always gravelly and ironic because in spite of everything, she still smokes cigarettes. Am I late? I had to buy these new tights. Look at this. Is that shine? Don't you love it? She goes over and stubs her cigarette in the sink and wets the end and throws it in the trash can. Shit, we gotta hurry. Henry always notices if you're late. Last week he wouldn't let one of them dance, the one who always wears the silver leotard. I run after her. She snaps the front of her leotard as we trot down the hall. At the door, I put my hands on hers, holding it closed. She looks at me. I say, Rhonda, wait a minute. And I tell her. Then I open the door and walk in. Henry has started pliés. I take my place in line. 2 minutes later, I feel Rhonda behind me and everything about her, her sadness and her fear as well as her presence. She gives out a little moan. Henry casts her a glance. He says, there is a thread attached to that spot on the back of your head where the hair swirls around. You know that spot? Just a thread. If you let your spine stretch upward as your buttocks drop down, you won't break that thread. My chin drops. The vertebrae seem to release one another and float. This is it, isn't it? What Jake calls God and Jonathan calls passion. I lift my arms and drop and spread my shoulders, then turn. Rhonda is there, and her face is white, and her expression is dismayed. She would like a cigarette. This is it, isn't it? This movement, movement, only the feeling of life running through the tissues. After all, it makes me smile. A second later, my sister smiles back.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to Amy Brenneman's performance of The Life of the Body by Jane Smiley. And if you did, please support us by becoming a contributing patron or enthusiast member today at wordtheater.org. You will have free access to our live streams, and you will take pleasure knowing you're helping defray the costs of producing our podcast, among other things. Also, we encourage you to pick up books by our esteemed authors at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater. But of course, if you're completely broke, just sign up as a free listener or make a little donation. We got $20 from somebody the other day, and it makes a difference.
We're so proud and incredibly grateful to all these outstanding actors who come back again and again to work with us at Word Theatre.
Thank you, Jonathan Sachs, for composing our theme music, and Jonathan Escobedo, our podcast editor. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles.
Until next week, Kirsty Pearn in England, signing off.